Once again, a little something from the fabulous one, Adele Shea. I fell in love with my husband Jay for the first time last weekend. Though we've spent more than 12 years together, I had never seen him before. And then I did. What I had seen before that moment was a story. I wrote about who he is and what he will or will not do. I saw black hair, then gray hair, then ear hair. I saw behaviors I deemed as good and bad and appropriate and not. And I responded according to my perceptions at any given time. This day he was good, that bad. This moment he was doing it right, that wrong. This moment he was wise, that deluded. This moment his appearance was acceptable, that unacceptable, and on the story went. Each time I read my story about whom he is, whether he was in the room or not, I would feel happy or sad, angry or loving, irritated or accepting. Inside those thoughts, who can be seen? There is no presence inside a thought, no illumination of what is appearing. What I saw were my own opinions, which I reacted to accordingly. Great suffering existed in living like that, even with a husband whom I thought I adored. Then the light came on, and there he was before me. Beautiful beyond description, and in that moment I realized that I had never seen anyone or anything before. A startling realization I highly recommend. Jay appears different to me now. His ear hairs do not bother me. His face is perfection. His body exquisite. There is nothing to change in him or his behavior. There is nothing to change in me. How do perceptual changes like that happen? I have absolutely no idea. But I have a story. And this is a story of what appeared to happen. Perceptions began to change when I began to look inside for answers. They changed dramatically when I regularly began to meditate. That is to simply to sit and to watch my thoughts. And when I began to hang out with people who had a higher state of consciousness, for lack of a better term, about how to look inside for answers. 13 years ago, I began thinking with my eyes closed for 3 minutes a day. When Jay and I began dating, we began the practice together. For years, with lessening intensity, I felt as though I would crawl out of my skin during that time. No peace existed in those sessions for a long time. My mind would frantically search for and seize thoughts. Then flashes of quiet would come without words. A feeling of perfect okayness would overcome me for a nanosecond, and then longer. A deep sigh would fill me. In those instances, there was nothing to do, nothing to fix, nothing to change. Sometimes I practiced that discipline for one day and then not for a week or a month. Other times I did it more consistently for a while and then not and then again. Trying to make myself meditate for 20 or 30 minutes during that period did not work for me. I found it impossible to return to that amount of time once missed, so I would simply stop sitting for long periods. I did not stop shaving my armpits or wear patchouli oil or levitate, though I thought I was supposed to do those things before I actually began sitting still. I did try listening to my breath and using a contemplative word. Mine was shalom, to repeat whenever my mind drifted, and using a number of other exercises, all of which were helpful, I found nothing more beneficial then place my fanny in a chair. It was tremendously helpful to sit with Jay. More often than not, one of us would not feel like sitting and the other would be encouraging. I found I liked my husband better on the days that we sat together. Over the years, the days of sitting still got closer and closer. I stayed at 3 minutes for more than 11 years. Slowly, the time expanded on its own. This year, it moved to about 20 minutes in the morning and 15 minutes to an hour, 3 to 5 times a week with a group of people doing the same. The decision to do that happened organically. Attempting to force myself to meditate more always produced less meditation. Somewhere along the line, I stopped trying to meditate. The practice appeared to change rather quickly after that. That's my story. You have my permission to ask Jay how it's going. I want to talk a little bit about being with girls sober. I was 40 years old, and my first marriage was ending. My sponsor said I left my marriage so I could get into a relationship. And this was done consciously. You know, I'd done everything that I could. I'd been as supportive of Jacqueline as I could be, and we were not able to make things work. And thank God that we both had sponsors, and we were both on this path, and so that when I came to her and I said that I can't live like this anymore, because I could not stay in a relationship that was just a friendship any longer. And I knew that I was going to start looking elsewhere for affection, and so instead of going and doing that, or her going out and spending money, or causing some event so we could blame each other or make something wrong, we were able to accept responsibility for our inability to create a loving union. And so what I did I did a sexual inventory. And this sexual inventory had nothing to do with what I'd done wrong. But what I did is that I sat down and... because I knew that I was 40 years old. My last dating was done when people took toothbrushes to bars. You know, 1980. So my dating skills were off just a little bit. It had been, you know, a decade and a half almost. And I knew that because I had left my marriage, that I had really scarred my daughter, who was only 5 at the time. And I knew that everything that I did would be watched and observed. And that the only way that I could hope to make amends for what I was doing to Jessica was to try and comport myself in such a way that I could always look her in the eye. Now, at the time, I had coffee bars on 2 college campuses. I'm vice president of a large church. And I'm active in AA. There were a lot of suspects. And I sat down and I started to write a list. And I had to, what is it that I want in a partner? I had never sat down and consciously thought about that. I'd always walked into a room and waited for my hormones to go off and then tried to have my way with whatever the creature was. But I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew that that probably wasn't it. And the great thing about being a sober member of AA is we know that there are 2 kinds of examples in AA. There are good examples and bad examples. I could go out and I could lease a Harley and get some leather chaps and get some ink, and I could, you know, start sitting at the back of the room and try and date girls that were closer to my daughter's age than my own. I know that wouldn't happen to anyone in the Parker Men Stag, but in our group there are a few. Not in the Hermosa Beach Men Stag, but one of those other meetings that are around the neighborhood. And so I knew that that wasn't the way to go. So what I did is I took a look at the fact that I'm a 40-year-old guy and I got a 5-year-old daughter that I'm going to be responsible for. For me, Alcoholics Anonymous is the most important thing in my life. So if I'm looking for someone to share my life with, they've got to be a member of a fellowship. The most important activity that I'm involved in Alcoholics Anonymous is sponsorship. Therefore, I want somebody that not only has a sponsor, but that is sponsoring people. Third thing that I'm looking for is a woman that has done her sexual recovery work, because if she's in the fellowship, she's going to have to have done that work. Chances are. I wanted my daughter to maybe also have some alternative choice about people that had different experiences. Her mother, a brilliant woman, had never gone to college. So I thought that maybe a woman that was a professional woman might be somebody that would be somebody that... And then I was looking for somebody that was artistic and somebody that, you know, that in their recovery at least demonstrated some spiritual panache. And then I've got a couple of personal little things that I like. I like tall girls, so, you know, that went on there. And a couple other personal things. And then I started filtering. And you know, I mean, there were a lot of gals that I knew, but, you know, there were some that were just serial daters, so I knew that that was probably somebody that I didn't want to get involved with unless I was just looking for excitement, and I was not... did not want to model that behavior with my in front of my daughter, even though she didn't live with me. But I, you know, again, modeling that behavior. So when I went through all of that, the woman that was on the top of the list was Adele Shea. And when I left my marriage, I left with less stuff, because stuff was only there for my daughter's benefit. I left with less stuff than I had when I went to college, when I went off to college. And so I knew I wasn't going to out-hip anybody. And I didn't have a lot of money, because I was giving the successful business to Jackie, and I had something that was scuffling. And so I took her out. We went to coffee a couple of times. I realized that the targeting system was pretty good. And I said to her, you know, my marriage is ending. And I know that amongst intelligent women that there is a period of time that separated men are not dateable. And I know that you're not involved with anyone at this time. But I really think that we could have a good time together. Please do not fall in love with anyone until you have the chance to get to know me. I approached her as if she was the person that I wanted to spend my life with. And when I go home today, I am going home to the person on the whole planet that I want to be with. And I approached her like that from the gate. Now, I've talked about going to these retreats. And I was on this retreat in about 1982, and there was this guy, Father Shepherd, who was leading part of the retreat, and he was an old Jesuit, had a collar on, and he said from the podium, don't screw him. What? What are you talking about? I mean, okay, he's got the uniform on. He's supposed to say that, right? And besides, he's celibate. He doesn't even know what he's asking me to give up. Right? That's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. But here I am, and I'm approaching this woman, and this is the one on the top of the list. I want to play this for keeps. And the more I got to know her, the more I wanted to play it for keeps. The first time I had the privilege of kissing her, I stepped back and I looked at her and I said, I can't sleep with you. And she gave me that look. It's a little forward. And I told her, I heard this one time a long time ago. And I want to try something different. I know what happens doing things the way that I used to do it. I want to try something different. Are you game? She looked at me a little strange. She said, okay. And so after another week or two, when we really decided that this thing might we're going for, I said, why don't we do this? Valentine's Day is a couple months off. Let's pick that as the day. And what it did is it took all the pressure off of us getting to know each other. And a couple other things. And remember, I, especially anybody that, if they're listening to this and they haven't heard the other talk, that Adele has given me leave to talk about this, because I didn't know about dating. I didn't know about getting intimate. I didn't know any of that stuff. And we started praying together. And then when we first started sleeping together, what we did is that we started and we went really, really slow. And I'm going to be very Clinton-esque about this, okay? Is that we started out and we spent some time kissing, but we didn't have sex. And then we, you know, got to first base. And we spent like a week there. And we went through all the processes, but we didn't finish it off. And what happened is that each and every expression of love a human being can have as an evolutionary thing, we were able to experience as something of and by itself instead of something on the means to an end. And so no matter how it is that we express affection, it's complete. I never knew that was available. I never knew that was available. And the most important thing is that the power got taken out of it. Sex had always been a power exchange for me. If I do this, you'll do that. It wasn't that. It wasn't that. And if you follow this path, what'll happen, you know, and I'm not saying that we didn't have a whole lot of fun in that time leading up to that, but it was in stages. And if you follow this, one of the things that'll happen is that other energy will start coming in. And two or three times during the course of this period of time, there was an event in each of our lives where the best possible response from the other person was for us to make love completely. And we didn't do it. And so we learned to trust each other on a level that I had never experienced in intimacy. We got to know each other, because once you complete the sexual act, what you do is you stick them in a box and you always keep going back to that same box. And then when it was time, what we did is we left where we lived, or where we were, we had separate domiciles, but we left our town and we went off and we celebrated and made it a sacred time together. And that was 14 years ago. And a lot of guys that I work with have done this. And the thing that happens is that, you know, a lot of times things don't work out. But people are always able to be in the room together. Nobody ever feels like their trust was violated, because it's all done up front. It's all done with honor. It's all done with love. It's all done with respect. I didn't know that was possible. So, you know, again, part of being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous with some experiences, I want to share with you the great successes and joys of my life. And my home and my marriage is the greatest joy and success of my life. Followed very closely by the fact that my daughter will call me and tell me, because I do that with her. I call her and I tell her, I texted her and said, I'm in the Stanley Hotel, Red Rum, you know. And she's a goth chick, so she just loved that, you know. And she calls her father and tells me when the good stuff is going on, you know. I'm in Vegas, and Marilyn Manson just got done painting my big toe. You know, I mean, the significant things in her life. And she's off at it and having a wonderful time. So I want to share that with you, and that they always talk about dating in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. But I want to share with you that if you are looking for a mate, make sure they've got a sponsor. It makes life so much easier. It makes life so much easier. Because I've had time dating sober women who didn't understand that they might have a problem too, or a part in it. And believe me, it's a lot better. The other thing that I did with Adele is I asked her, when I was courting her, I said, look, you know, sponsorship is the biggest thing in my life. I said, are you willing to be a double agent? Because I'm working with all these guys, and will you help them when they're starting to get together with women, and can you talk to them, and can you help them? And she's guided some guys that were, you know, I could only in my mind see that without God's grace them having lots and lots of years of therapy, and maybe someday they'd get to own a chia pet. And and some of these guys are married to the greatest women members of Alcoholics Anonymous in my neighborhood. When my daughter was 12 years old, she'd gotten confirmed in the Episcopal Church to please her father. It's very sweet of her to do that. She says, Dad, I don't believe in about 50% of this stuff. And I said, well, neither do I. It's no big deal, darling. But I said, I'm really glad that you went through this and that you at least learned the principles upon which this nation basically is founded, and the stories that were part of that, the development of the consciousness of this country. And she looked at me and she said, you know, Dad, it's all about the friends now. And I remember that time. I remember that time when my parents had split and I had to go and spend my times of obligation with my father. My daughter had come to be with me. I picked her up. She hung with me on Tuesday evenings. I'd pick her up from school. And then every Friday, I'd pick her up from school and I'd take her home Sunday afternoon. And I didn't go out and do any AA stuff really during that time, you know, because I had a commitment. I had a commitment. And she said, it's all about the friends now. And I realized that really was what was up. And I said, okay, baby, I tell you what. I talked to her mother, and I said, you don't ever have to come and spend the night with me anymore. I want you to come when you can and when you want to and all that stuff. You know, that kid has never come and spent a night at my house since. And that was like 7 years ago. But she called me, and we'd hang out a lot. And a couple years ago, I was... I said to her, sweetheart, you know how you're... I said to her, You remember when we had this conversation? I said, did you feel when I said that you could go and do what it was that you wanted to do, that what I was doing was I was abandoning my fatherly job? She paused for a second. She said, well, no, Dad, I felt that what happened is that I was now socially adept and I needed to find my way, and you wanted to support me in doing that. And I thought it was the most loving thing probably that you've done. And then I asked her, I said, are you willing to be a double agent now? I said, you know how your stepmother works with my guys. I've got lots of guys who have teenage daughters who are having trouble or doing this or that. If I give them your phone number, will you tell them the truth? And so now she works as a covert agent also. And guys, I give them her phone number, and you know, this is after they've spent $1 zillion in therapy and they've been to, you know, this and that and another thing, and they're getting all the samplings from all the different people, and they call my daughter and they come back to me and they say, you know, the kid told me the truth. These are the prayers I have for you. These are the hopes that I have for you. So, let's switch gears a little bit. Now that we've got the family stuff done. Our co-founder, Bill, had this dramatic white light experience. And and then the book comes out, and in the meetings, everybody's waiting for their turn to have one, and they're comparing their insides to Bill's story, to his white light experience, and they're waiting for it. And if they don't get it, they're feeling like they haven't gotten the whole deal. And Bill was very, very clear. Later in his life, he got very, very articulate about this idea of what William James called the educational variety, a gradual unfoldment of an experience. James said that the folks that have the dramatic type, what happens is that experience has been gestating, incubating in their hearts and their minds, and then something happens, and all of a sudden, bam, they get it. In other people, it's the same gestation, but it's just not as sudden. Wilson talked about the only difference between the two types he believed was in the time factor. Because the results, it's in the fruits of the experience that it's validated. And the fruit of his experience was not drinking. And he said there is no experience. He says he always used to tell this story about, you know, you'd be sitting in a meeting and a guy will say, he'll be up there taking his first year cake and he'll go, I don't have the spiritual angle on this program. I haven't seen any white light. And then he'll go through and he'll talk about how the fact that he hasn't had anything to drink, that his wife's happy to see him when he comes home, that his employer is pleased with the work that he does, that his children speak to him in complete sentences. He says, and those of us who know, that is it. That is the spiritual experience. And he just hasn't gotten to the point that he can put it into those words yet. And so each and every man that is here today has had a spiritual experience. We're all here and we're sober. And so what I'd like you to do in your group is I'd like you to talk about your experience. Now, with some of you, I know that in a group this size, there's a few guys that have had a dramatic flash. You know, I mean, it's just a numbers game. And there are other people that have had, as it talks about in We Agnostics, there have been one moment when we've beheld a flower and we've known. And with others, it was maybe the first time that your child walked across the room in a long time and put their head against your chest. Or it may just be the moment that you thought that maybe my sponsor isn't bludgeoning me, that what he's doing is he's loving me. So what I'd like to do, because I think that this is a very important thing, let's spend 3 minutes again in silence, and then we'll... Can we do the picture after the group? Yeah. Let's do this. We're going to break up anyway. We'll go do the picture. But let's bring our hearts and minds together for a moment. And let's ask, you know, that would be open so that in your group you can talk about your personal experience. This is a Jay the Alcoholic. Thank you. This is from Bill Wilson's letter to Carl Jung. My release from the alcohol obsession was immediate. At once I knew I was a free man. Shortly following my experience, my friend Ebby came to the hospital bringing me a copy of William James's Varieties of Religious Experience. This book gave me the realization that most conversion experiences, whatever their variety, do have a common denominator of ego collapse at depth. The individual faces an impossible dilemma. In my case, the dilemma had been created by my compulsive drinking and the deep feeling of hopelessness had been vastly deepened by my doctor. It was still deepened more by my alcoholic friend when he acquainted me with your verdict of hopelessness respecting Roland. In the wake of my spiritual experience, there came a vision of a society of alcoholics, each identifying with and transmitting his experience to the next, chain style. If each sufferer were to carry the news of the scientific hopelessness of alcoholism to each new prospect, he might be able to lay open every newcomer to the transforming spiritual experience. This concept proved to be the foundation of such success as Alcoholics Anonymous has achieved. This has made conversion experiences, nearly every variety reported by James, available on almost a wholesale basis. Our sustained recoveries over the last quarter century number about 300,000. In America and throughout the world, there are today 8,000 groups. So to you, to Dr. Shoemaker of the Oxford groups, to William James, and to my own physician, Dr. Silkworth, we of AA owe this tremendous benefaction. As you will now clearly see, this astonishing chain of events actually started long ago in your consulting room, and it was directly founded upon your own humility and deep perception. Very many thoughtful AA students are attracted to your writings because of your conviction that man is something more than intellect, emotion, and $2 worth of chemicals. You have especially endeared yourself to us. How our society grew, developed its traditions for unity, and structured its functioning will be seen in the text and pamphlet material that I am sending you. You will also be interested to learn that in addition to the spiritual experience, many AAs report a great variety of psychic phenomena, the cumulative weight of which is very considerable. Other members have, following their recovery in AA, been much helped by your practitioners. A few have been intrigued by the I Ching and your remarkable introduction to that work. Please be certain that your place in the affection and in the history of the fellowship is like no other. Sincerely, William Jones. So what we did earlier is we talked about our experience. We go around talking about faith. But faith, I think, is entirely overrated. We have experience. We have experience. Couple stories about mine. I was about 8 months sober, and I was sitting in the meeting, the 2+2 meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Westwood Community Church on LaGrange and Westwood Boulevard. I was in amends. I was sponsoring people, and I was sitting there and I was listening to a woman speak, and her name was Liz LaPresti. And Liz was talking, and she talked about how that alcohol stripped from her everything that makes a human being a human being, and that what she became was an animal. And when she said that last word, the room left. And I was sitting there. I had the consciousness of sitting in my seat, of the chair, and a vague sense of the room, but it was all gone, and there was nothing but a vast white light. And my head said, "Oh, maybe this is an LSD flashback." And my heart said, "No, pay attention." And as I sat there, the feeling that I had, it wasn't words really, it was a feeling. And the feeling was that everything is known. And that everything is perfect. And that everything is connected. But we got an 8 month sober guy involved here. So in my mind, I formulate a question, because I understood that I was in the presence of whatever is. And I said, well, in my mind, I said, well, what about war? And the feeling I had was, don't worry. And so I sat there in that for another minute. And then, because I'm involved, I come up with another question. I started to ask a question about abortion in the back of my head. It started to come up. I'm asking another question in the presence of all knowledge. And the feeling was, I couldn't even quite phrase it in my mind. It was, and I sat there, and I don't know if I was there for 8 minutes or 12 minutes. This was only a 20-minute talk the speaker was giving. And before she finished, gradually, the room started to come back in. And this particular church, podium that the speaker's in, had is here, and there's three stained glass windows. And stained glass windows were the first thing that came into my sight, and the windows say, God is love. And then gradually the room came back, and I looked around, and it was very obvious that nobody else had that experience, and I was afraid, you know. And I sat there, and somehow the intuitive voice inside of me said, you know, just be quiet. Now, there's something to be said about spiritual secrecy. You know, when you're on the path, don't go putting your neck out when, you know, with folks that aren't going to be supportive of it. You know, it's like going and telling people that you buy dope from that you're sober. You know, they'll just go, oh, here, have a free one. You know, So, you know, spiritual secrecy is important as we build ourselves up. I didn't tell anybody about that for about 3 weeks. And then late at night at the coffee bar, I mentioned it to an old timer, and he said, "Yeah, kid, this stuff happens all the time. Don't worry about it. We don't talk about it in the meetings because we don't want to scare the newcomer." And so I did. I said something once, maybe a couple weeks later at a meeting, and a guy called me a liar and came over a chair at me. And AA in those days, there were chairs flying and people grabbing at folks. And guys would stand on their chair and share. It was an exciting time. We weren't quite as civilized as we are now. And then I went and I found my old parish priest and I told him what happened. And he said to me, and he had his childhood friend there with him that was also a priest. And he said, "Yeah, kid, that's," he said, "I've had," he said, "I wish that was my story." He said, "But it's not." And he said, "But I've had a couple of parishioners over the years tell me about these things, and that sounds like what it is." That he said, that's the real deal. And his friend worked at a seminary down in Texas, and he said, "Come with me now." He said, "I'll get you a scholarship. You need to go to work being a professional God person." And I went, no, thank you. Because I knew that with my ego that was not something that I should be doing. I had another experience where I was, it was not long after this, maybe 3 or 4 months after our stag meeting. We were standing there, was a new guy and my friend John Cleary, and I had my hand on Cleary, and I'm talking to the new guy, and I'm going, you know, God is as real as we are right here, and I touched him on the chest, and we all three went, and the newcomer hit the door running. My friend John looked at me and I looked at him and he left, and like 3 weeks later he quit going to AA because he knew that he had had a spiritual experience and he didn't need to come anymore. 8 years later, when he came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I reminded him of this experience after he'd been sober for about 6 months, he said that when he took the first drink, the memory of that vanished. He remembered that something happened, but the experience vanished from him. My great shame about that experience and how I processed it is not that I was quiet about it. I knew that I could go running after it and I could go, you know. But I said, no, this was a free gift that came to me. And it came to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I have stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of being faithful to that experience. But up until about 9 years ago, I lived my life basically as a faithful member of Alcoholics Anonymous and not in the awareness of that experience having happened to me. Not living every moment as if everything is known. It's okay. And we are all, it's all connected. And then about 9 years ago, a friend of mine was talking to Father Terry, who's a professional God person, and he was describing somebody else's experience. And I went, oh, I guess I should start to talk about mine. And so I do it when I come on retreats, and I do it if I talk, you know, on Sunday morning at a convention, but I don't really talk about it in AA much except when it's on topic. But my experience is that. Now, everybody in here knows that the reason that you don't want to do a third step is that the last thing that you want to ever do is end up being a missionary in a third world country, right? Because it's not cool. Now, cool is, you know, lying in the gutter in your own urine, right? But I don't want to end up being a missionary in some third world country. Well, when I was 20 years sober, I went off to a place that I go, and I went with I met with this spiritual director, and I was trying to see whether being involved in this retreat stuff was my ego or whether it was a real calling, and I felt it was a calling, and so I went to this man who, and you know, I spent a week there in silence, and we'd get together. And he said, you know, after 3 days, he said, "No, kid, it's all right. Go ahead, and I'll help you." So, but while I was up there, I turned my way. You know, I mean, you know, when you have these moments, I mean, when you turn 1 year sober and 5 years sober and 10 and 15 and 20 and 25, you know, these big moments. Of course, they're no more important than the day, but you know, honor it. Honor this experience that we're having. So I turned my life well over the care of God in, you know, a very profound way, and sober man goes back home to Southern California. And I'm sitting there a few weeks later, I'm sitting in this church. Now, when I say church, I'm not saying what you think I'm saying. But I'm sitting at this place that I went to get fed. The guy was a contemplative and very, very helpful to me. Very, very helpful to me. And it was in that place that I met Father Keating. And so anyway, I'm sitting at this place, and a guy gets up and he goes, "I just came back from vacation in Belize. I met a guy who I think's really cool, and he's working with a refugee community on the Guatemalan border. And they said that they gave him land. This woman gave him land, and we can build a church for this guy. And I think it'd be really good to give him a center of operations. And what it'll really be is it'll be a community center and blah 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 blah." So I'm sitting there now. And my head goes, "Oh, well, that'd be really fun for somebody else. I don't got the time, and I don't got the money." And so but the problem is, I've been meditating for a number of years by this time, and I know that my head is really useless for most important things. I mean, even the food choices it makes are really mostly stupid if I listen to it. And so I go, "Oh yeah, I just got done turning my will and my life over." So I stand up. I'll go. So I go home to the nice Jewish wife and say, "I'm going to build a house for Jesus down in Central America. I don't have time. Don't have money." She looks at me and she says, "My darling, if you can't leave that business for 2 weeks to go and have that experience, that business isn't worth having." She says, "Ask your customers. They'll send you just for entertainment value." So I did. And they came up with the money, and they all had the same prayer: "Don't let him touch any power tools." They know me. So I go down with this group, and I'm down on the Guatemalan border. When I say Belize, I'm not saying what you think I'm saying, man. I'm not talking about the K's and string bikinis. I'm talking about, you know, people that are busy moving. Like 30% of our brothers and sisters in Latin America are moving in one way or another, out of one place to another, trying to find some place that they can stay long enough. And so what we were doing down there is trying to help people to stay, to get a school, to get some stuff going. So I'm down there for about 3 days. Now, I go to AA wherever I am. I always go to meetings wherever I am. And I'm starting to look at my fellow volunteers and evaluating their level of spiritual awareness. And I realized that it'd probably be a good idea for me to go to an AA meeting. So I walk up to this Guatemalan priest, and I say, "Yo busco Alcoholics Anonymous." And he dissolved into tears. And he goes, Yo soy alcoholico. And there in the middle of the jungle in Central America, that man told me his story. And I told him mine. And every place that I have gone, in the past 29 years, when I'm thinking that I'm doing something for this creative principle, God as I understand God, what do I get? I get you. I get Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I just happen to be on the dummy squad, you know. I mean, I'm always getting hit with the big stick, you know. And because the only reason that I do this work is because I can tell a story and that I'm willing to share myself. It's in our brokenness that we are useful. Sober man is good for many things. But it's my scar tissue that is helpful. That is really helpful. Now, if you could do anything in the world, God calling. If you could do anything in the world, what would you do? What would you do? Would you drink socially and be able to date the twins? Is that what you'd want to do? I ask myself that. I ask myself that every New Year's now. And a number of years ago, what came to me was that meditation had been so helpful to me that I wanted to do whatever I could to help introduce people to that. Now, you've heard me talk a little bit about the Oxford Group, and there was a guy by the name of Frank Buchman, who's the guy that got the Oxford Group rolling. And in 1938, they changed the name to Moral Rearmament. And in 1935, over the weekend of December 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, this worldwide network of people that he was involved with, they put radio broadcasts in every nation in the world in that language, trying to get people to meditate to what they called listening for guidance so that they could get their representatives to stand down. The most outlandish thing I ever heard of. The most outlandish thing I ever heard of. And anyway, what I did was, in homage to him, I got together with my spiritual teacher, and I started a website, and it's called, guess what? 3 minutes, the number 3minutesofsilence.org. The number 3 minutes, plural, of silence.org. And what we do is that we try to get together, every year at one day, one moment, the same time, for 3 minutes, folks all over the planet, to spend 3 minutes in silence in any form of meditation, prayer, or personal reflection, that we might find an answer that is above party, above class, above religion, above faction, above race, and above nation. And that we may have justice whereby we see not only others' difficulties, but our own. And that we might bridge seemingly impossible and humanly hopeless situations. Those are Buchman's lines. And on it, there's this wheel. And there are a dozen different meditative practices. There's this little labyrinth here for walking meditation. And if you were to click it, you could go to Estes Park, Colorado, and they would talk about the labyrinth that's here for you to walk. Or any place that you are, you can find a walking meditation. For the chanting of Om, I've got a friend of mine, Tenzin Pradaharshi, who's a venerable monk, chanting Om on this wheel here. I've got some stuff from the Jains, their meditative practice. Marvelous, the oldest Hindu sect. Incredible what they've got. I've got some wonderful Sufi stuff here. At the 7 o'clock hour, there's the thing from Initiatives of Change about how to listen. It's the meditative practice that Dr. Bob and Bill and all the early members were taught. I put it in modern language, but it's all in our big book, but it's the actual wording and structure the way that they did it. And it's a writing meditation. If you say, oh, I can't be quiet. Well, it's a way of being able to get into contact with your interior self. And then the one that I want to recommend to you is on the third hour. It's an infinity symbol. And if you click on that, there's my friend Dulcie Smith, who's been a student of Joel Goldsmith for the past 30 years, doing the awareness exercise. And it's a 10-minute guided meditation to try. And then if you do it, like if you try doing it every day or once or twice a week, it's a real good way to learn how to get that split. Because when we're quiet, what happens is that first shift between our mind and our awareness. And which is the one, you know? And so it's a wonderful thing. And you just click on it, and you can download it, or you can listen to it. It's. But I did that, and what happened is that I've had a wonderful, wonderful experience in going along and trying to say, hey, come this way. But again, try it like you drank. Try it like you used. There's all kinds of stuff. The only thing that's necessary is that you take the first step. You know, the big lie about meditation is that somehow it's airy-fairy. It's not. It's blue-collar. All you do is clock in and clock out. Put your ass in the seat for 3 minutes and see what happens. And see what happens. And it's a great, great adventure. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And along this path, you know, you'll meet teachers. Now, our friend Dave is the gatekeeper to my friend Keating. He'll be happy to tell you about Keating and about the centering prayer method, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And especially if you're from a Christian background, it's a really wonderful way to go. But I want to talk about my current terrorizing men. Because it's a lot of fun to do. Earlier in the meeting, we were talking about what can I take home. How many guys here have roommates? You know, and wives. And girlfriends. Yeah. Oh. Two bagger. Here, honey, would you put the wig on tonight? Spiritual practice. It's amazing how shallow I am. I just love it. Once I embraced it, it was all okay. But anyway, I implore you. You know, in the book it says we beg of you, and we're talking about what can we take home. When you go home, go to your loved one and say, honey, I want to watch Oprah with you. Okay? Not that. Now, I want to tell you, something's going on. And this man, Eckhart Tolle, that the boys are going to be studying, this amazing master who I believe saved my wife's life, who I've spent 7 years studying his stuff, who is the only person that I have been able always to recommend to anybody in the fellowship because he doesn't use medieval language at all, maybe says God once an hour, uses the word love occasionally because it's all been so warped. And he gives very, very clear, simple direction on being present. This woman, Oprah Winfrey, 5 years ago picked his book, The Power of Now, up and made it one of her book selections, and a lot of people really responded to it. Then this latest book that he's come out with, The Power of A New Earth, she made that a selection. And it's amazing what it is that is happening. this man who I believe is like my friend Thomas Keating, Thich Nhat Hanh. I mean, the guys who, Pema Chodron, you know, so that we make sure that you understand that there is a feminine aspect also. That Marianne Williamson, there's just a lot of folks that have got this, but this is a guy that's got it, and he's very, very clear. She is getting together once a week, and they're reading the book. He actually helped her put together a study guide. And what you can do is you can help to make your home a spiritual powerhouse, and you don't have to say shit. All you have to do is say, honey, you know that woman that you think's pretty cool that I've been denigrating for the past 2 decades? Can we watch her together? And you go to oprah.com and you can download it. This is week 8, but you can download it so you got it on your hard drive. You buy the book, you read the thing, and then you watch them talk. And what they're doing is they've hooked in with Skype, and people all over the planet are doing this thing at the same moment. They've had over 14 million downloads. And they're being quiet for like 15 seconds, which, you know, in broadcast media is an eternity. And there are all these people throughout the planet that are coming together. And there's some good, solid spiritual direction and practice that you can get that's really easy. And it's not a big leap. And it's presented very, very simply and very, very lovingly. And these people from all over the world are coming in and they're calling and they're asking questions. You know, like people that are evangelical Christians calling in and saying, I can't reconcile the language you use with this. And he said, well, don't worry, throw my book away. He said, get any book by Joel Goldsmith. It uses the Christian nomenclature for exactly the same thing. Or people calling up and asking him questions about their children or their relationships. And you know, and it's just incredible. And so I really, really hope that, you know, that you take advantage of that. And then if you can stop and join in with the boys and go through the process with them, it will be amazing. And it's only like 10 weeks, 12 weeks long. And what happens is that shift will happen. And once it happens, it's just like getting sober, man. It's on. It's on. And this is the journey. This is the journey. There is no topping out in the 11th step. And you are surrounded with weirdos like Michael and Roger that will be more than happy to show you, you know, they're just like the guy with all the psychedelics. Here, try this. Try this. Try this. Try this. Oh, you didn't like that? Try this. Oh, here, the mushrooms. Try the mushrooms. Okay? You know, I mean, you're not going to be hurt in the spiritual search unless you get around people that tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous is a lower form of understanding. I want to read you one thing from a man who had a lot to do with the establishment of the consciousness of Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern California and AA as we know it. And my friend Gil makes his CDs available. It's Chuck Chamberlain, A New Pair of Glasses. And it's a wonderful, wonderful piece. He was an amazing force in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Chuck had this to say. He said, there is only one problem in this life. One problem that includes all problems. And one answer that includes all answers. I am totally convinced that the only roadblock between me and you and me and God is the human ego. The only roadblock there is. I further believe that the best definition you'll ever hear of the human ego is the feeling of conscious separation from. From what? from everything. Conscious separation from God, from each other, and eventually from ourselves. And what's the solution? The solution for me is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Is in the 11th step and the 12th step and the first and the second and the third and the fourth and all that stuff. Don't ever fire anybody. If God sends them to you, you can't hurt them. You can't hurt them. And who are we to throw anyone away? Always answer the phone. There is no conflict with spiritual truth. Always say yes. And everybody always goes, well, they're going to say that I have to go set up, they asked me to set up chairs New Year's Eve. If you've got a commitment to your family, you have a commitment. It's okay. And there is no conflict there. There is no conflict there. But always say yes. Always say yes. Say a couple more words, and then I want to seal this with 5 minutes of quiet. My card's up here with the website, my phone number, my email address. I have no idea why we were together this weekend, but I know that I am responsible. And that if you ever want to talk, all I'm really going to tell you is, do you have a sponsor? Are you sponsoring people? Are you? So, but I am available, and it's my great privilege. And if you come through Los Angeles, call me, or if there's somebody you know who's coming, I'll make sure you get to a good AA meeting, you know. And if it's a woman, my wife will do the same. The holiest place in the world is being in the birthing room. The second holiest place is being in the room where it gives the appearance that someone is dying. But the third holiest place is at the kitchen table, turning pages, sharing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each and every man in here, there is a life whom you are destined to save. And if you're not in the meeting, if you're not making yourself available, what will happen when that man comes through the door? You can't hurt him. Open your heart and have the experience of sitting there when a man goes, oh my gosh, this will work for me. I am like that. I can do this with God's help. To be there at the second birth is the most amazing experience that anyone can have. And it is a worthwhile ride of excitement. Talk to any of us that have been around for a little while. You know, it's in a marvelous, marvelous thing. I love this piece. It's attributed to our Hopi brothers, and I think it probably is a wonderful, wonderful expression of the Parker men's stag. This supposedly was written just after 9/11. You have been telling people that this is the 11th hour. Now you must go back and tell the people that this is the hour. And there are things to be considered. Where are you living? What are you doing? What are your relationships? Are you in right relation? Where is your water? Know your garden. It is time to speak your truth. Create your community. Be good to each other. And do not look outside yourself for the leader. This could be a good time. There is a river flowing very fast. It is so great and so swift, and there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel they are being torn apart. They will suffer greatly. No, the river has a destination. The elders say, we must let go of the shore, push off into the middle of the river, keep our eyes open and our heads above the water. See who is there with you and celebrate. At this time in history, we are to take nothing personally, least of all ourselves. For the moment we do, our spiritual growth comes to a halt. The time of the lone wolf is over. Gather yourselves. Banish the word struggle from your attitude and your vocabulary. All that we do now must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration. We are the ones that we have been waiting for. Thank you. Let's do 5 minutes of silence.